lives and works in Toronto, where she also teaches figure drawing, painting, and portraiture at the Ontario College of Art and Design University. In addition to being a founding member of the Loop Gallery, Maria has also been invited to sit on juries, panel discussion, conferences, and has worked in film and theater. Her work is represented in private and corporate collections in Canada, the United States, South Korea, and Europe. Libby Haig is a Toronto-based artist and graduate of the Fine Art Program at Concordia University in Montreal. Her work is also currently on show in the traveling exhibition IPCNY at the University of Texas in Austin. Her recent solo exhibitions include Sympathetic Connections at the Art Gallery of Ontario, We Were Young and Still Believed in Heaven at Galerie Circulaire in Montreal, Tien Moi Très Fort, La Centrale, Montreal, and Being Natural at the Durham Art Gallery. Our moderator today, John Armstrong, lives in Toronto and is an artist, educator, curator, and writer. He has exhibited his solo work across Canada and, in a full-fledged collaboration with artist Paul Collins, who lives in Paris, has had over 20 exhibitions in Canada and France since 2002. Their collaborative work includes painting, writing, photography, and video. John has curated exhibitions in Toronto for Mercer Union, the Museum for Textiles and Harbourfront Centre, in Peterborough for ArtSpace, and in Kingston for the Agnes Etherton Arts Centre. He has published many reviews and articles, and his writing has appeared in publications including Arts Atlantic, Boarding Crossing, C Magazine, Canadian Art, and Parachute. Since 1982, he has instructed in the studio division of the Joint Sheridan and University of Toronto Art and Art History Program. He holds an MA from Chelsea School of Art in London and a BFA from Mount Wilson University. Welcome, and I hope you enjoy the question and answer today.
Okay, well, thank you. Shall I just start?
Yeah,
thank you for the invitation. I've known Libby for many years. Libby and I worked together on the Art and Art History program. But I just met Maria today, so that's a new experience for me. I guess when I was looking, when I first thought about the juxtaposition of these artists, the thing that struck me was the idea of narrative, and it's been a bit of a bugaboo in the history of art over the last, say, about 300 years. When we think back to 18th and 19th century work, artists very often were asked to depict, the big kind of narratives that hold society together, which we nowadays call meta-narratives, mythologies, histories, subjects that told a story that we all knew the answer to. So often these paintings were didactic, they taught us a lesson, they were tautological, the conclusion was something we all shared and knew about and was reiterated several times in the painting. So this relationship to literature, often something depicted would be a dramatic moment, the kind of denouement of the story. So the structure of literature kind of threaded its way through visual art in an interesting way. Now, when I was a student in the 1970s, this was anathema. We weren't meant to think about narrative in paintings. Paintings were meant to concern themselves simply with matters specific to paintings, sculpture to matters specific to sculpture, print with matters specific to print, and so on. But with the rise of, I guess, postmodernism, with the idea that artists are thinking about their cultural background, about displacement, are thinking about questions such as sexual orientation, gender definitions, and so on, that artists have tried to look at ways of introducing narrative, I guess, back into art. And that's the point at which I'd like to start here, because I think both these artists work with narratives in different ways. I mean, I don't think they're the kind of totalizing narratives that we've seen in the last two centuries, but nevertheless, they're perhaps partial narratives and narratives that are broken and can be reconfigured in various ways. So perhaps, I don't know if either of you would like to comment on the kinds of stories that your work presents to the viewer.
I thought you were going to pick it up. Well, of course, you're just seeing a slice of my work. I think, you know, other things I've done that have been more sort of immersive environments, the narrative's been more obvious. But in that work, which you're not seeing now, there was always a material aspect to it. And I think in this work, I'm dealing more with material aspects. And if there is narrative, it's sort of perhaps implicit in the informal problems. For instance, that sounds pretty vague, but for instance, if you... I've often been concerned with ideas about fragility of civilized life, and I liked a phrase from a writer, Martha Nussbaum, called the fragility of goodness. So I'm very aware that you know, everything that we value is can be taken from us, and in a way, I think it's not a huge stretch to think in terms of paper carrying that message, that paper is a very beautiful thing. If you thought about making it, you'd be aware of just how complex, how challenging that would be. But it's also so fragile and so vulnerable. So it does carry some of that narrative, but you have to kind of search around for it, I suppose. So I don't know, maybe that's a place to start. Yeah. How helpful that is, but...
Well, I think most of all, the first thing that comes to mind is in connection to what I am thinking about in my work is just this not a very new notion of expressing the invisible through visible. And I've been preoccupied with that, as of course many visual artists are. And the human body, the figure, has been a big theme in my work that I love with a passion, and I hope that comes across, because I fell in love with that subject matter, even though I use other subject matter in my work many years ago, and I come from a family of artists that are both figurative artists, so it's something that was a really part of my growing up in a studio, actually. And it's something that I've researched, a subject matter that's very rich and I think very relevant still today in any kind of visual art. And I see the figure as a means of expression, of expressing something that is the invisible part of the human soul and spirituality. And that's something that I'm very interested in. And I do, of course, like a lot also the connection with the art, the history of visual, especially the Western visual art, where there is such a rich treasures, such rich treasures of figurative art, or art of where the theme is the human figure. And as I see, like many artists today, also revisiting and kind of crossing bridge over centuries and looking into some of the works of art that sometimes almost lost their meaning, or they are still very appealing and speak to people even though they don't know that narrative. And that is a very kind of puzzling aspect of that, how that meaning, even though maybe it's not as known in detail, it still attracts or the people of today in our contemporary world with all kinds of postmodern theories and many different theories in art and cultures that happen, that still people can be enriched and somehow receive something from the works from the past. And this is some partly in here that I'm revisiting some of that the sculptures of Matthias Braun in the Czech Republic in Kuks. It's a very unusual place, and so there the figures of vices and virtues, the sculptures, are the allegorical figures. And I'm, you know, wondering, like, you know, is that theme still, does it have anything to tell us today? You know, how do we think of virtues and vices? Or, you know, the memento mori is also a theme there. So I think that's probably, I would like to leave it at that. I don't want to keep on.
No. I mean, it's interesting. Libby has seen narrative implicit in materials, and Maria has seen narrative and implicit in the tradition of figural art. I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, we have here two, well-established, mature artists whose work is divergent, which is something that the Loop Gallery often presents us with, which is, I think often more effective than providing obvious links between the artists. But I guess the next question that comes to my mind is the relationship that you each have, you know, thinking of this, the nature of materials and the tradition of figural art, the relation you each have to traditional practice and how this is embodied in your work. Libby comes out of a print tradition and actually edited a magazine on contemporary printmaking in Canada. She did an excellent job of that, of course. So her involvement with that tradition is certainly rich and long-standing. And, you know, obviously the level of mastery that you have with the figure is very impressive. And, you know, I think as artists, we learn to work within those traditions, and then we're able to move outside them and in some way question those traditions. So just, I guess my question is essentially how have you, brought the concerns of the material and conceptual framework of the practice in which you were first trained to bear on your new work? How do you think that relates?
Well, for me, I think that one of the breakthroughs was when I started ignoring a lot of the basic rules that I had been taught and that I had accepted. As a printmaker, we were taught like not to put pins through the paper, that our goal was to do reproducible editions and everything should be exactly the same. I think more the paper was treated with a certain reverence, but the edition as a goal was also something that was a standard that we sought. And for me, I think the breakthrough was when I started working with Japanese paper, and I didn't have to handle it in the same way. That it sounds so simple, you know, but when you put a piece up on a wall with a pin, I'll show you. Like, if I take this, I used to be worried, like, if I pin something on the wall, that I would damage the piece. And then I realized, I can't even see that hole. So I thought, why am I obsessing about that? And one of the reasons I wanted to sort of install the show this way is I thought I could show some of the freedom that I had when I stopped thinking about the material as, yes, it's important to me, but it's not as precious. And then I found, like, I can staple, I can cut, I can glue. If I don't like it, I can cut again and re-glue. But it gave me this feeling of real freedom to explore with things. And as a printmaker, I'd always loved having the drying racks with the whole edition there. Like, I was caught by the power of the multiple and seeing lots of the same thing. And so I would build up metaphors, really, by printing the same thing, but instead of thinking of it as an edition, I thought of it as an adaptable unit, a modular piece, and then I could have like a very small link, a section of chain link fence, let's say, or if I printed an enormous amount, I could put 20, 30 feet up, and then it was like a real physical barrier, but I could adapt it to the space, and it was really very liberating. And I've kind of worked the same way with my watercolors, which are the basis, sort of the underlying basis of the pieces in the plexi boxes, where you know, I would tear them up and glue them back together and just keep struggling with it and always trying to feel like I could risk it. And in the installation of this show, I decided to put them in those plexi boxes. And the thing that I, like the last agonizing thing for me there was that when you frame watercolors a certain way, you're supposed to do it. But every convention has limitations, and you're attracted to the convention because it does good things for you. But then you forget like how bound you are. So you traditionally frame it in a frame, like with a window mat or something like that. But what you don't do is glue it to a piece of board, because then like you cannot get it off of there. So that's one step you can't like. You can't erase that step. So I was really kind of frightened to glue them to the boards, but then having done that, I thought, okay, now I've got something I can hammer into this, like, you know, so it encouraged me to get more physical with it. So that was, I was like, wow, I'm happy I did that, but I was really scared to do that. So so anyway, that's it. You know, like, everything is just, there's just so much risk. It maybe doesn't seem it to anybody, but like, the more you work on something, the more you're emotionally invested, and the harder it is to take that step. But you know, I can maybe make it a little better. So sometimes you need to have distance and time, like, so that you don't care so much. But it's pretty, I think that's why it's tiring and exciting and mysterious. Like, oh my God, I'm so tired. I need to take a break. You know, it's tough work. It really is. But anyway, so that was it's the pin.
Maria, do you have a pin equivalent?
Well,
metaphorically.
Everywhere. Anyway, it's like I relate so much what Libby says, because I majored in printmaking too.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I loved. Oh. I did mostly etching and lithograph and woodcuts and so on, but then kind of gravitated more into drawing and painting. And so, you know, I love paper too, even like making three-dimensional things, like sort of almost like sculptures, but I love painting or drawing on paper as well. These are on mylar, so this is a little bit different material that actually, because people often ask me when they see it, like, what does it feel to work on that? And in my first attempt drawing with oil stick on, or even drawing with charcoal on these, it made me think of drawing on lithostone. It's a beautiful feeling, you know, when you draw on the lithostone. It is some kind of different, you know, the tooth of it, and just the way, you know, the line happens. And so this is very similar to that. And I mean, then I did my last body of work that I had at Loop was done in mostly oil sticks, mostly like drawing, where these are more going into painting, where I used oil sticks and also oil paint. You know, see where, I don't know how that will evolve, but the fact also of, you know, just pinning the work to the wall is something I kind of had to finally accept, that I can do that in a gallery, and of course seeing other artists, you know, displaying the work in that way. I think, you know, for me, one of the main components of my creative process, or that is always full of surprises and unpredictable events and ups and downs and blocks and all kinds of other things that I'm sure everybody else goes in their own work through that. But it's, for me, the art of, or the process of observing, I think, is very observing reality, observing what I'm looking at, and understanding, trying to understand that through the process of observational drawing. I have not really grown tired of that kind of way of working in relation to, or of working from some references or photographs and so on, which are also, you know, it's a great way to work with this kind of subject matter. I remember, you know, when I was maybe like 23, I came across a quote from Leonardo da Vinci in his notes on painting, and it stayed with me since then, and it was something in the meaning, I can't quote it exactly, but it was, for painting is the way to know the maker of all marvelous things. And so in a sense it's kind of a theological statement, because it's through observing reality, it's getting to know, and sitting and spending time looking at landscape, trees, or small details, somebody's foot, or their eyes, or anything. It's taking that time, you know, that is what is so amazing. And of course that process also brings certain frustrations along, and anybody or any artist that have tried it knows how different that is from, you know, working just by oneself in a more calm, kind of peaceful environment of the studio. Well, for example, here, these were all done with two alive models, and that one is based on a sculpture, part of those Baroque sculptures by Matthias Braun. So it's that one I, for example, used photographs, and then there, the piece with Czech President Václav Havel, they obviously did not pose for me, because when I did that, it was just, I did that as a response, it was the last piece in this work that I did as a response to his passing away recently. And I saw a video, and that was very, it was just an amazing half an hour video that was aired on the Czech TV on New Year's Day. And this is these two former mates from jail, former political dissidents, and they were discussing their lives since that time, since they met until now. And it inspired me so much that I, with the help of my husband, he helped me with the technical difficulties to then work from that and choose certain positions. So, you know, that was a different kind of work. So I think that's probably
them. Well, the idea of tradition, I was just going to ask you a supplemental question. You know, when you look back to the Baroque work of Matthias Braun, which obviously is informed by observation, as your work is, and the realist tradition of observational rendering. Also, you know, obviously there's, you know, an interest in madness and theatricality and so on in those from sculptures, and that you know, the agitation and movement of the Baroque movement, which it seems to me is in the main quite different from the work that you have presented here. So I just wondered how do you see the relationship between this Czech Baroque artist and what you're doing now? How does he inform your work?
Oh, it's just the start, you know. And there, like, it's one attempt, and you know, I, for example, that figure, I placed the skull under her foot. Mm-hmm. It was not there, you know. And it's like these little interventions. I often work, you know, maybe with a there's a desire, and it almost does not have a form, and an urge to, you know, you almost see something. So I often. I kind of only can think of it like groping in the dark, and I don't know often where it's heading at all. And I was, you know, I was just so totally drawn to the, as they say, genius loci of Cook's, you know, that the place has such an atmosphere. It's an unusual, very unique place. But there's also some woods nearby where there are sculptures that Matthias Braun actually carved into the rocks in the woods. So there's sort of hermits, and, you know, some of them are half disintegrated. And I was really kind of very taken by that. And I thought, like, I just wanted to revisit those themes. So in that sense, you know, maybe the movement and the kind of turbulence of the Baroque. Although, you know, there's something about the Baroque that I think is, like, quite contemporary, actually, mm-hmm. in us. Mm-hmm. You know, we can find that, like, in the things that are going on. And especially when one sort of finds some literature that sort of can enlighten that, like for me, then I find the connection there, you know. But I think that this is probably just starting. This figure, you know, is based on one of the sculptures, but I originally wanted to incorporate the sculpture in it, this one here. It's the figure of wisdom, which has two faces. One is, you know, it's like looking forward. The other one is looking back, reflecting on what has happened. And then she's also holding a mirror and looking, you know. So I just, in the end, ended up just doing the model, you know, and that's where it's at now. I hope that there will be more variations on this.
So there's a number of exhibitions at the moment on the neo-Baroque impulse in contemporary art.
So you see, I'm right there.
Most recently at Museum London.
Zeitgeist, right?
Absolutely.
I would like to know more about that.
Now, if we think about Maria's interest in this specific place in Czechoslovakia, it's interesting that Libby has proposed the studio as her conceit, I guess. I mean, it is a report on the studio, but it's also, like you were saying earlier, obviously a manufactured vision of the studio. And the studio is an interesting and persistent motif in art. And the image that immediately comes to my mind when I think of the studio is, of course, Matisse's Red Studio. So this was a place, you know, a lot of Matisse's work, proposed a space that was aside from the hurly-burly of the world and Baroque tendencies, this idea of a kind of laboratory, a place where one could, experiment with how things might be presented, how things looked. But his concerns were very formal, and it was a very, it was this kind of French bourgeois interior, essentially. And so this idea of Matisse's idea of art being a kind of metaphorical armchair for the tired mental worker at the end of the day. We make art in our studio, and then it moves along into somebody else's home, and finds an equivalent and meaningful and hopefully rewarding on an ongoing basis role in that person's home. But I think maybe we can think a little bit about the presentation of work in the gallery as well. But this idea of a studio is maybe quite divergent from the one that Matisse presented. And I think it's interesting here that both of you have, for example, photographs from contemporary political events. So there's a kind of sense that there's a permeable membrane you're presenting here between the studio, the artwork, and your sources.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're looking at me, so...
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that Loop lets you do is you can show things in a different way than you can in most commercial galleries. And so I wanted to take advantage of that, and I've had people, ask me where I get ideas, and in a way, what I wanted to show was how ideas develop. I wanted to the subtitle of the piece is "More Light, Less Darkness," which is an inversion of a phrase from Timothy Findlay, who was writing a book called Headhunter, and he was. Doing a modern sort of take on Heart of Darkness. And I think there's enough like evil and darkness in the world that I think the counterpart to that is really the two things. One is the sort of the creative life that we have, and the other is our relationships with people. So the sustaining relationships that we have as human beings and what we make that's creative are the two things I think that really kind of redeem us as a species. And I think I keep thinking people would be happier if they made work. And so really I'm just trying to, in some ways, I'm not saying everybody can be an artist, because I know you're setting people up for failure if you say you can do this, because people aren't going to work as hard as we do, or, you know, there's different levels of talent, but I still feel people can, if they would look back into the times when they were children, let's say, everybody was creative at that point. And I think this is, you know, I'm being perhaps overly optimistic, but I thought if I could show people how ideas develop, they wouldn't be so terrified, and people would think, like, they would be drawn to sort of connecting with that part of themselves that is good, that they can, that would give them satisfaction. And I actually think that's where craft comes in, because with craft you have established parameters, and you can be creative within a framework that will allow you to succeed and find satisfaction. So it's partly wanting people to just find more pleasure in their lives, really, by making things. That I wanted to set the studio with the work that comes out of the studio to show, like, the origins of ideas, and how if you're paying attention to little things, like Maria was saying, the shoes or the feet or whatever the things are, if you really keenly pay attention, that you can sort of transform that source interest into something else. And so that's why I have the pictures up. And if we go to any artist studio they have, or their home, there's usually, like, there's rocks and there's little things that we found, and it's because we're paying attention. And that's the other thing that art does, it trains us to pay attention to, you know, the way an oil slick looks on a puddle or something. And that's something that also gives you like happiness, really, because it shows you the beauty that's in your life, and if you just pay attention, it's there for you. It's like a present, you know. So that's partly why the studio, why the sources, and how the work comes out of that. So that's my thinking.
That's it. That makes sense. Yeah. Now, Maria, when I look at Figaro work, especially a piece such as this, you know, I immediately think of the artist studio. I immediately think of the role of the artist as an observer, and you know, as I said earlier, the kind of quiescence of the studio and so on. Is when you put up an exhibition like this, do you think about how the viewers might imagine your studio, might imagine this idea of observation? Is there any way in the installation of the work that you reinforce this notion of a particular setting in which the work is produced?
Well, I've had thoughts of setting up an easel in the gallery with a model, you know, and just painting or continuing to work, and sort of bringing a, you know, corner of the studio, like which really, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that the most fascinating part, and I don't know if maybe in some of my other works there were maybe more hints at it when there was an interior. I've done other compositions when there's more of an interior or a space actually painted, and then may have more suggested the atmosphere of the studio. But in these works, I have not really, you know, kind of considered that. I mean, it was really work done from, I would say, inner absolute necessity, bordering on despair, or just really like, you know, something that has had to, you know, I had to do it, and under a lot of time pressure also. And I want to say, you know, that one of the most precious and amazing aspects of that is the work with the models. And it's not like of course, one thing is doing portraits of someone like John or like my husband, you know, friends, but there's also, you know, work that one wants to, is actually seeking, searching for ideas that are somehow in my mind, in my heart. And then the model, you know, if I can find someone that will be so sensitive that they will work with me. And this is the model that she was actually here at the opening. And, you know, that's like, it's not so easy to find. You know, it's a very special collaboration, really, and demands a certain sensitivity and openness, you know, like you know, I don't know, maybe not everybody would want, be wanting to sitting, you know, with their hands on a human skull, you know. So it's like, it's just an example of something that is a little bit unusual. It's not an everyday occurrence. And I did speak with her, for example, about this, the theme of like a contemporary version seeking for Mary Magdalene. You know, who was Mary Magdalene? This figure that is often in art history, you can see many, many versions of interpretations of that figure. And obviously there are chapters. I have one book here, two books here actually, you know, one, Image and Spirit in Sacred and Secular Art. There's a whole chapter on the history of Mary Magdalene, you know, throughout centuries, like what different kind of artists did with that figure, which remains still very enigmatic in a sense, and different between the biblical figure and then the Christian tradition interpretation of that figure, which can be very different. You know, and then there's some beautiful paintings of Mary Magdalene. Here is Georges de Latour. You know, that's a beautiful essay, actually. Like, so I just brought these books here because there's texts in there that have really, you know, part of the inspiration behind that in throughout this book.
So I mean, when I look at your work, I do think of the studio because of the tradition of the painter and the model. But I'm wondering about just ways to bring that through to the viewer, and I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the scale of your figures and their presence for us as real people.
The scale? You mean the life-size scale?
I mean, you've chosen to paint them like
yeah, I find that the most exciting, like, I love working life-size, which is, of course, creates a problem with storage later on. But, you know, that doesn't end up in somebody's home, which is also like a bit difficult, you know. But I there's something about working with the figure on a life-size scale that is just. I mean, I find that I work really fast, you know, and sometimes of course like things get thrown out or taken off and so on. But I think there's something about that scale that is just, you know, very very exciting for me, and I need that. I need that kind of inner. Impulse and charge, because otherwise if I work, or you know, I mean, I have worked smaller and I probably will again, just for practical reasons maybe, but I just find it that I'm the happiest with what happens, like if I work on that scale. And I think it's because it sort of relates, you know, when people confront it or stand in front of it, maybe, you know, but I actually haven't asked anybody about that, and maybe it's a good question. You know, if that has to do anything with how it communicates, how the work, you know, and what it communicates. And,
well, it does for me, you know, because you do get that. I mean,
presence.
I'm able to some way imagine myself as you, you know, in front of the actual model, because the model has that
That's
scale and presence. So the model is perhaps less of an abstraction and more present.
Yeah. Thank you.
See now, maybe I'll just have two more questions, then we can open it up. You know, it's interesting when you do have an exhibition with two artists whose work does not immediately establish a clear, you know, sort of connection. And I think the most difficult exhibitions to present are group exhibitions or two or three person exhibitions, because if they're successful, I think of them as changing the way that I might look at each artist's work. So the work is framed and recontextualized through the juxtaposition with the work of another artist. So I guess the big question for me, you know, was to try to figure out how, you know, how that happened for me. But I'm just wondering for both of you if the opportunity of exhibiting with one another has afforded you the a new view on your work. Or at least, you know, wow, this is...
Well, I think it's something we all sort of deal with it, because there's always two people having shows here. And sometimes the work is just a natural fit, and other times it's not a natural fit, but it's human nature to try and find meaning, whether it's just there or not. And so we all struggle with, we're trying to find connections. So I think, you know, Maria and I have done this from the beginning. You know, we're trying to find the connection between in the work, and maybe it exists on a more sort of, well, sort of on an abstract level, that we're the darkness and the light and things like that. Also, I think because I was wanting to show how work changes when it leaves the studio and it's presented in different degrees of formality, it was a nice option for me to, which I'm glad it worked out, that on that one wall at the front on the right, there was, originally we were just going to put piece of mine and a piece of Maria's, and then it seemed like, oh, well, there's a meeting ground in the middle where her floral piece was next to one of my little abstract pieces. And by bringing them close together, and they're sort of compositionally, like they kind of read well together, there's a little bit of a color link there too. It's a way for the work to communicate sort of more closely one with the other. And just to, so even just abstractly, to think in terms of like how her work and mine can meet together in this sort of smaller space within the bigger gallery. Just because it's an opportunity to sort of to learn something, because it's not a pairing that would necessarily come naturally, but you know, it just seemed like, oh, this is lovely. This, the little floral wasn't going to work. Well, I mean, actually, it would have worked a number of other places, but just, oh, here's an opportunity to see what happens when the work is in that kind of dialogue, and the work answers that question. That's my cup.
No, that's good.
No, but I mean, like, it was kind of interesting to see. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that happens is you really get to know somebody else quite well. And so it's an opportunity, that's a pleasurable opportunity. I hope most of the cases it is for people at Loop. I think it is. So.
Yeah, there's actually two more right there together.
Oh, yeah, that's true. They're a little separate, so mm-hmm. But the ones up there, there's a little more of a dialogue between the works.
Yeah, that was, you know, as an exhibiting artist here, it's always an unexpected adventure, really, to have the show with another artist. And I had to say that for me, they've always been, like, amazing experiences with the other artists. And you mentioned about learning, and that I feel that, you know, very enriching and learning experience, you know, from the other artists. And I thought that was amazing when I first actually read your press release, you know, that there was this, you know, your title. Mm-hmm. And because that was, I was thinking, obviously, about the light, you know, I mean, in another dimension, maybe, light and dark, and the whole phenomenon of light is such a big theme, obviously not just in my work, but I am very attracted to that, as to what all light can be in terms of modeling of a form, or in terms of being just a symbol of something spiritual, and the contrast and chiaroscuro. I remember reading about you, did you like Caravaggio very much? Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's, you know, I also, obviously, this, the title, and I struggled with even making a decision about that, using that title for my exhibition, Memento Mori, and it is dark. It's something that, I mean, generally is not a, you know, something, some kind of a entertaining, it doesn't come to mind an entertaining aspect of that, but my intent, also relating to what I'm still more and more curious about what is, you hinted at something about, like, more about your theme of light and darkness, like more light, less darkness, and I hope we can continue that conversation sometimes. And, you know, for me, the darkness is a place of where some of these figures are, either because of sorrow or because of contemplation of meaning of life or loss of meaning and so on, is that in that place, that's my intent, is that there is a moment of a very real gleam of light and hope. And it's that kind of contrast of despair or darkness and then light and hopefulness and then, you know, pondering those big themes of mortality and immortality and all that that was my intention, that is part of, you know, having a figure contemplating, having a symbol, the skull being the symbol or representing the passing nature of our existence. So I've had a lot of those thoughts because my father passed away recently, but I actually created these before that happened. So it was almost like, I just thought I'd mention that because it's kind of a very personal place from which a lot of that work is coming from.
Okay, perhaps continuing in this sort of metaphysical vein, something that struck me when I first looked at the show was the idea of time, how each of your work embodies time in an interesting way. I think it's also interesting you both have photographs in your installations in one way or another, and yet, you know, largely the photographs are simply points of departure or contradicted. The kind of instantaneity of photography doesn't inform your work, and certainly Libby's work of patterning and mechanical reproduction of that patterning in some instances and then in other instances not, and certainly in your work the unknowable amount of time that you spend on each of these images. A painting is an accretion of many small moments that it's impossible for us to know as viewers. But I think both these things are strategies that artists use to engage the viewer, that making something is very important, and we're impressed by the amount of time that we try to grapple with as viewers, I think, when we look at the work. But I guess my question is just... what role do you feel time plays in your work, and how autonomous do you think your work is? To what degree are you presenting small glimpses, fragments of time, and how do you think that plays out in the interpretation of your work?
I'm always happy to show because I produce a lot of work, and if I'm not constantly showing, then people, or if people miss shows, then they can't sort of see the logic of the work. I've come to think, well, I used to be quite insecure about that because people would always say, oh, your work's so different. And I'd think, oh, I thought it was a real criticism. And then I came to think, well, you know, it should change to a certain extent. And I think that over time, the continuity of certain themes that kind of keep... that are sustained are sort of a reflection of my myself and what's sort of most central to me. The narrative that you spoke of at the beginning, I think it will enter into the work again. It's just at this point it's going through a more material exploration phase. I think it's that idea that you need the long view of yourself and other people's work to really sort of understand it, perhaps. So, you know, I guess I'm old enough, I'm seeing my work in its own, and the continuity with which it, or the continuum that it's a part of at any one time. I'm actually thinking of reintegrating the figure in my work, actually. So we'll see.
And maybe you're thinking of reintegrating the pattern. Print back of your work. Now, how do you think of time?
I start to think about since you put the question is about like the time it takes to draw from, let's say, a model or in a landscape, and the kind of contemplation and meditation one can go through. If it's with a model, it's very different because sometimes we talk or listen to music. But the time, I mean, this is such a big difference, I would say, between a photograph, and I do take a lot of photographs, I love photography, and the difference are being of what a photograph captures, a great photograph, and the portrait, let's say, or whatever it is that is in the image, the time that has taken that one was looking. So, for example, the expression on the face changes every second, and you spend, you know, several sessions with a model. Well, all that goes in that painting. It's not just one moment, and so it's a very interesting aspect of that. For example, other times, you know, I love to do also like just gesture, very quick kind of rough drawings, and they sometimes capture, sometimes something like that captures or expresses more, or something. I would say it's much more satisfying to me or successful in terms of what it actually expresses than something that I have worked on for a long time. So the time, I would say, it plays a big role in this work. I mean, you know, with these, sometimes I would have maybe two different sessions with this, you know, which is each maybe about to 2 or 3 hours you spend together with some breaks. And, you know, like that one was obviously like the whole figure takes longer because there's a lot more consideration of proportions, or, you know, whether one is distorting or stylizing the figure, it doesn't matter. It's like just a bigger territory one has to cover. And, you know, it's amazing how one little thing means with the figure means so much. I mean, just the turning of a hand or turning of a face, tilting of a head, or, you know, anything makes an impact on what comes across. So some of these are sometimes reworked, right? If you're not happy with that, and sometimes it's very difficult to even find out what it is that does not work.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm sort of been a hog up here and asked all the questions. Which has been a real privilege. You know, you're in the audience, you've got a lot of questions you'd like to ask. You only have really an opportunity to ask one. So it's been fun to ask a number of questions. But do you guys have any questions for these two fine artists? Yes.
It does seem to me like there is a link between your hands and both hands together, I think, a little bit in terms of studio time and working. It seems to me like, is there a link between the both of these? There's a lot of work here. It looks like a lot of labor. And so, like, obviously, you're both kind of, you know, picking up again and doing a lot of work. Is that true? Is it something that's like a constant? Is that important? Is it? What's the role of sort of, you know, intense labor?
I don't know if it's. I would say that I think of it that way. It's just the nature of what I love to do is that it does take. I mean, like, I find that I grow or discover things through work. And sometimes then, of course, like, has to be a distance and one has to reflect. I find also that reflecting and just pausing and looking at what's happened, like, you know, I believe it's essential to have a dialogue with your own work and not just to impose something all the time. So, you know, there's a lot more other stuff that went into deep into these, right, as you can probably imagine. So for me, it's just the nature of the subject matter with these, especially with the figure, that I do a lot of like preparatory kind of, you know, search. It's for me, it's a search for what that final idea might become. So.
And how often do you go to the studio in a given week?
Oh, it really varies. I would say for many years very managed, a very disciplined. I love to be in my studio. That's where I want to be the most, apart from traveling. But balancing it with some teaching also, depending on the schedule. So if the schedule gets really bad, then it's less, and then one becomes a very unpleasant person to be around, because artists, when they can't do their, spend some time in the studio, it just become a different person. You become a different person. You know, I'm sure everybody, you know, because sometimes life is like that, right? We go through things that don't allow us to be in the studio. But as much as I can, I had a studio on DuPont Street for 18 years, and it was one of the best times, like a bigger, a lot of work that happened there, because it was good light, and it was a community of artists actually there. And then we were all kicked out a few years ago. These condominiums are going up. You know, between Davenport and DuPont and Davenport, that section that is not being redeveloped. There was a question.
Well, sorry. You know, I'm like Maria. If I'm not working, I just feel like I'm not in touch with the essential part of myself. And I also feel like if I'm working, like cutting something, things that are tasks or putting dots on paper, filling in the little squares on those prints with dots, I am doing something that is somewhat directed, but it's somewhat not directed effort. And so your mind is free and it's concentrated and it's wandering at the same time. And so ideas come out of that very fertile situation. I also find I start something I don't necessarily know what it's going to be, and I know enough that I don't wait for an inspiration. I just pick up something and I start. And it's like your hand, your body has its own intelligence, and it directs you to the next step. And just as I was saying, you know, it's our instinct to try and link Maria's work and my work. I try and link, having made that first gesture, my brain starts to make the second one. I read about John Chamberlain, this sculptor I like, and how he makes his work. He has this space that's like an aircraft hangar, and he has pieces of crumpled cars, and he actually has a studio assistant who crumples car parts for him. And so what he has is these aisles, and it's like a critical mass of crumpled car parts. I think, unfortunately, he might have died.
He just died, yeah.
And he walks up and down the aisles, and he picks one spot, one piece, and he picks it up, and then immediately you think you're looking for something to respond to that. So it's the idea that through working, through being in motion, through making the first decision, the first step, that the next steps kind of come. And so, you know, people that just don't start never get anywhere. But I think if you're constantly working, you're constantly engaging in new ideas, and it's exciting. I think that's why, well, first, that's why we love being in our studio, and that's the political aspect of the studio that is, in fact, very much present today, because people are losing their studios, and it's an expensive city, and without a studio, I don't, you know, how can artists develop their ideas? You know, without a space, affordable space to work. And that's a big change I've seen in Toronto since the late 70s when I came here, is that it's more and more expensive to be an artist. So artists have more part-time jobs generally, or they're teaching, and they're scrambling. And wherever they find that affordable studio space. I mean, the only sort of comparable, affordable thing that we have that's an alternative is maybe our sketchbook, where you can sort of stay in touch with being an artist if you don't have a space, but really, you need that space. It's a huge problem.
Yes?
In Urbanova's work, it's figurative art, but I also see that the faces are very impressive as well. So what do you put the emphasis? Does the figure help the face, or does the face help the figure and say something? Or what do you put the emphasis?
I think that you know. I mean, I like what you said. They draw strength from each other, and obviously, like you know, that one here, the lament, has no face. It happened very quickly, that work, and I almost started to put a face in, and then I kind of stopped. I was so exhausted when I did it. I had to go away and not look at it, and then I came back and. And then almost I had other ideas what to do with it, and then I left it. And I even left the absence of that, you know, just this sort of expression of pain or sadness and lament. And I mean, for me, it is a bit of a tension because I love portraiture. I am fascinated by the uniqueness of an individual, how we are all such individuals, and no one unlike, not another person like on the planet. You know, so that is always like an amazing challenge. And so sometimes when one does a whole figure, like sometimes I don't go there too much, just in suggestion. But in these, I obviously, you know, went into almost like a portrait of them. I mean, she looks quite a lot like this. The other ones are a little bit somewhat removed, you know. So it's something that I think I will play with more, you know, what you just said. Like, you know, either one or the other, or, you know, like sometimes I just have a completely like a linear, like a gesture. But I will do nothing, no modeling, just the gesture, but the face will be more developed, you know, or nothing. So it's, I don't know if that helps.
Well, does it, the face make the figure stronger, or does the figure make the face stronger?
Sure. I don't know if I can be a judge of that.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank you all for your kind attention today. You know, it's interesting. There's an exhibition at the Ontario Crafts Council, which I think runs for one more week, curated by a woodworker and sculptor named Joel Robson, and it's called Losing Harkdale, and features the work of a number of artists, artists and craftspeople who work in wood, whose studios have been closed because of condos and so on. So I think it is a real issue that we are losing, as artists, the opportunity for conversations. And certainly, this tradition at Loop is, I think, it doesn't entirely replace that reality that we all enjoyed or have enjoyed up till now, but it certainly is an important thing. And thank you all for coming.
Taking time out of your studio, perhaps.
Oh, you're
welcome. Yeah. Thank you. There's some cheese and some juice.
Oh, yes. Yeah, they are. They're amazing. Seriously, the one with the gold.